I just want to, I'm going to proceed rather informally here, assuming that you've at least had a chance to read the executive summary. As everyone on the phone would know, that the key issue here is the conflicting interests within the great state of Alaska. You have one of the largest sockeye salmon habitats, very valuable to the state of Alaska. You also have a situation where a large area, the Bristol Bay watershed area, is has been designated by the state of Alaska to be used for mining purposes as well. So you have a conflict, inherent conflict between these two great issues. So that's what is involved, is how to how is that to be resolved in terms of deciding whether or not mining would be permitted in the Bristol Bay watershed area. So that's the issue that was involved. And then the question is, how did I get involved? And it goes back to this fall. I think it was last October, I was approached by Mr. Tom Collier, whom I had never met before and do not know, or did not know at that time, who asked if I'd be willing to review the situation and give a an opinion on whether or not EPA had acted properly or fairly, I should say. And I said that I would look at some of the material and preliminarily to decide whether it was something I wanted to undertake. We represent a number of clients across the world, and this was one that I knew would take a good deal of time. And I indicated to him, after looking at the material preliminarily, that there seemed to be issues there that would warrant a further investigation on my part. And so in the spring, I guess it would be March or April, I agreed to conduct a further investigation, which has culminated in a report that has been issued this morning, late last night, early this morning. So the question becomes, why me? And I believe I'm suggesting that he came to me by virtue of the experience I had of 24 years on Capitol Hill, having served on the Government Affairs Committee and the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, having served during the impeachment of Richard Nixon, having served the investigation of Iran-Contra. So having had many opportunities to investigate the way in which government conducts itself during those 24 years, and then, of course, over at the Pentagon, spending the 4 years there during President Clinton's second term, I was able to oversee a number of environmental programs, because the Department of Defense basically spends about, at my time I was there, about $2 billion just on environmental programs, protection of critical habitat, because there are about 20 million acres of land that's under DOD jurisdiction. So I've had a good deal of background in terms of evaluating how government functions or is supposed to function. So I assume that is why he came to me. And I would like to think that I established over those actually 31 years of public service a reputation for fairness and one of independence. So I agreed to undertake this this investigation, and then the process I use is typical of what I've done throughout my lifetime. I used to be an attorney in my youth, and I both prosecuted cases and defended cases. But in every case that I ever undertook, it was to gather as many facts as possible, and then to gather from whatever source was available to me. In this particular case, I had to rely upon documents that were acquired through the FOIA process, through Mr. Collier's law firm, Steptoe and Johnson, who had acquired this information. I had tried to meet with current EPA officials, and the Justice Department declined to have them meet and talk with me, and I understand that because there are lawsuits pending, and there's also an OIG, IG investigation into what has taken place. So I completely understood why I was not able to talk to current EPA officials. But during the process, I made it clear that I would only undertake this effort if I could have the best law firm in the world representing me, and that happens to be DLA Piper. And we're in their building right now as I'm speaking to you. And I have been associated with DLA for the last 14 years and have the highest regard for them. I'm not part of their firm, but I have a strategic affiliation with the law firm and have the highest regard for the quality of the attorneys who are associated with it. It happens to be the largest law firm in the world, and I think, in my opinion, the best. But in any event, Charlie Shearer is here. Shearer's here with me today, and he led the effort to start accumulating the information. Reviewed some 42,500 documents, over 60 witnesses that were interviewed. And in addition to all of that information, one of the methods that I have used in the past has been to organize arguments, sort of a red team, blue team. And that means give me your best lawyers in the firm to take the case of EPA, and give me your best lawyers in the firm to take the case of Pebble. And in that way, I was able to gather as much information as possible to give me a better insight in terms of what the critical issues were and how they might be resolved. And so to try to put that in the context, in this particular case, the state of Alaska was granted 100 million acres of land. And within that 100 million acres, the Bristol Bay watershed area would encompass an area the size of the state of Ohio. That doesn't mean that's what the Pebble mining company would have an interest in, but that's the area that is under the jurisdiction of the state. And so the state has a vital interest in that region. And initially, it was sort of zoned. I wouldn't call it zoning, but it was specified that it would be the uses would be for fishing, sport fishing, as well as harvesting and mineral development. And then in 2005, the state modified that to say that it was for mineral acquisition. And that itself was controversial at the time, but that has been the state's interest to date. And so it really boiled down, after looking through all of these documents, and I recommend that you read it all because it's been painstaking in putting it all together, but I tried to organize it in a way to be as fair as possible to EPA and as fair as possible to Pebble, and say, here's how I see the fundamental issue to be resolved. 404C has been rarely used in the history of the Clean Water Act. As I point out in the report, it has been used only 13 times in its 43-year history. And secondly, not only has it only been used rarely, but it's never been used on a preemptive basis in the history of the Act. There was one case in Florida where it was used, but there were three mining proposals. Two of them had filed applications for dredging, and the third one was an adjacent parcel. And so the EPA felt that it had all of the information necessary based on the two other parcels to say they could make a judgment. But that was a very rare and extraordinary circumstance. And so the issue becomes one of fairness in the sense that Pebble has never been allowed to file an application so that the Army Corps of Engineers could then undertake, and by the way, under the Clean Water Act, it is the Army Corps of Engineers that is the lead agency as such. Once the application is filed for a permit to dredge, the Army Corps of Engineers then takes the initiative to work in conjunction with EPA, because EPA gives guidelines, and the Army Corps must exercise its functions within those guidelines and consistent with those guidelines. And then ultimately, EPA has the authority to overrule whatever the Army Corps would recommend. And so that has been the normal, what we call the NEPA process, whereby you comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, but, and that has been used throughout the history of the Clean Water Act itself. And so that process was not followed here. And so the state of Alaska, which objected to a peremptory veto by EPA from the very beginning, saying that we have a role here. You know, we are a state. We have been granted 100 million acres of land that belongs to us. And there are mining opportunities that we might wish to explore. And so you have to give us a fair opportunity to participate in a full and open examination of the facts and what the value judgment that will be made through this process, so that EPA would be able to look at the serious issues involving environmental, potential environmental damage, but also look at the interests of the state, as well as taking into account economic interests, cost-benefit issues that would be involved in the NEPA process, and also mitigation capabilities. That was not done in this particular case. And so in terms of fairness to the state or fairness to Pebble, they were cut short in this particular process. So I found no reason why it had to be done, when, in fact, if you follow the normal process, EPA is always in a position to, after getting all of the facts, that meant all of the economic facts, all of the environmental facts, and all of the cost-benefit ratios and mitigation efforts, then EPA is always in a position to exercise a veto. So in this particular case, they simply went on first and said, you can't file, or you can only file for a very limited mining operation, and that would they drew three hypotheticals. And this comes to the core of the reason I found it to be unfair. Under the Act, the Army Corps of Engineers is required to act in response to an application or for a permit that would have a designated site. And in that designated site, with all of the information that a Pebble or anyone else would have to file, the EPA would then be in a position to acquire that information through working through the lead agency, which is the Army Corps of Engineers. And so in acting preemptorily, they cut that process out. They cut the Army Corps of Engineers basically out. And you look at the report, you'll find the Corps did not participate in either the Bristol Bay watershed assessment, because they felt that would be a conflict, since they would have to rule or make a judgment under the NEPA process. And of course, the NEPA process never took place, and so they were not in a position to give any kind of recommendation. So basing a decision of this magnitude, and it has, you know, great impact upon the, potentially, upon the salmon industry, upon the tribal customs in the area, traditions, and it also has great potential from an economic development point of view. Given the magnitude of the issues involved, it seems to me it would have been certainly wiser, but I think ultimately much fairer to the state of Alaska and to Pebble to follow the normal procedure, because there was nothing that could be done. There was no jeopardy to anybody's industry or land until they went through the permitting process. And as the state of Alaska has pointed out, they have a pretty stringent permitting process with some 37 permits that have to be granted before a shovel of dirt can be overturned. So the state was saying, hey, we've got some interest here, and they're being pretty much minimized. And so I felt under the entire process looking at this, it would have been fairer and to have gone through the normal process. I thought it was unfair the way it was handled, in terms of using hypotheticals rather than a designated site with a complete application being submitted by Pebble. And so using hypotheticals, using 404C on a peremptory basis, to me, struck me as being fundamentally unfair. There were other issues involved which I frankly decided I was not in a position to make any judgment on. As to whether or not EPA acted and broke any rules or regulations, that's something that the court will decide. There are policy issues that Congress, in looking at 404C, will have to decide, because there is some evidence in the report that indicates that this process might be used as a model for watershed planning. And I don't know that Congress ever contemplated that EPA would be getting into the watershed planning business and to use this as a model. But that's something that Congress, and only Congress, can pass judgment on, and not me. And obviously, I didn't want to decide whether or not there were improper activities on the part of EPA, because I'm just not in a position to make that kind of a judgment. There are some concerns that were raised in the report that bothered me, and that is you have a key witness who is missing. Basically, Mr. Phil North, who was really a key to this entire process, retired, I think, in 2013, and I was told was sailing around the world and unavailable. And then I was told that he was in New Zealand, unavailable, and now I'm told he's in Australia and unavailable. And I think it will be very important for him to be available to the court or to the Congress to give a full explanation of his activities. He had his computer crash with no backup, so there are missing documents. And again, because there are missing documents, I don't want to prejudge it. These documents might be entirely benign. They might be very favorable to EPA. But the fact is that he's the only one in possession of information about what those emails contain, what documents were lost, and give a fuller explanation of what has happened. So I think, given the missing documents, given the missing witness, and the issue about inappropriate contact, not inappropriate, but substantially weighted in favor of the anti-mine petitioners, it seemed that these were issues that need to be addressed, but not by me. So my only very narrow ruling in the sense, or judgment in the sense, is that it was unfair to use 404C on a peremptory basis, and it was unfair to use it using hypotheticals. And that's the sum and substance. I looked at the process. Frankly, I'm not in the position and was not asked to comment on whether or not the mining should go forward or be rejected. That's not up to me. But I think as far as what I've tried to always do is really be consistent in saying it's the rule of law. The rules are established for people to follow. And if the rules are in any way compromised or shortcutted, then it raises questions about the legitimacy of the action taken. And in this particular case, I would say that EPA obviously has the power to override any state in dealing with protecting the environment, but it shouldn't ride roughshod over a state. And I think that, to me, was an element in this, that they really kind of gave short shrift to the state's concern. When the first report was filed, the state asked for an extension. They were given 60 days to review a document that was 1,000 pages long, and it came during a season in which it was the height of the fishery season, and they were overstressed. And as for an extension, it was rejected. And to me, again, that's evidence that EPA was not going to give due consideration to a partner under our federal government system, governmental system, is, you know, states have rights too, and they should be accorded deference, even though the federal government has the power in this particular instance. It's a question of how you use that power. In this case, I felt the power was used unfairly. So, end of my opening statement. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Manuel, or any questions from the phone?
I guess I'll ask real quick. What do you hope now comes from the report? You know, it doesn't seem like, you know, EPA is going to change its mind, but
I hope it'll be helpful to the IG. To members of Congress who will look at this and say, I've spent more than half a year, almost three quarters of a year, trying to synthesize all of this information to put it in a form that is fair. And I wanted to be very fair to EPA. I didn't want to question their motivations. You know, their job is to protect the environment, and I certainly stand behind that. And I have a pretty strong environmental record of my own. and have been endorsed over the years by most of the environmental groups. So I take the environment very seriously. But I also take the element of rule of law very seriously and say it has to be a fundamental element of fairness. Otherwise, the role of government is going to be called into question in terms of legitimacy and whether or not it's either politicized on one side or the other. And you can point to the hill and say, well, there are people up there who are on one side or the other. I don't have a stake in this matter as such. I said, I will take an independent view of this, and under the condition, number one, that I write what I feel are the issues and what I think the outcome of those issues should be in terms of resolution, and no changes can be made and will be made. This is strictly mine, and Pebble will have no opportunity to revise or amend or suggest any changes into what my recommendations were. So I hope it'll be seen as an independent analysis of the issues and a narrowing of the issues so that Congress can then focus on the other issues that it wants to focus on. They will have to decide, is this really 404C? Is this what we want as a policy, that the EPA should do this on a preemptive basis? Congress may decide that they don't want to do that. It may decide that it was appropriate, but I've at least tried to narrow the issues in a very serious, focused way and say, here are the fundamental issues from my perspective. There are other issues you may want to explore, namely whether or not there was inappropriate contact, whether or not this had been organized from the beginning. If you look, again, at the evidence, as early as 2005, Mr. North was suggesting that this was ripe for a 404C application. Now, that was 10 years ago, and there have been indications all along that they should move it along as quickly as possible. As a matter of fact, there's a document that indicates that they should complete the Bristol Bay Watershed assessment before Pebble has a chance to file its application. So, you know, those kinds of things need to be explored in greater depth to say whether or not this really was made, a determination was made early on in the game in terms of then orchestrating it. I don't reach a judgment as to that, but I think it's worth Congress looking at, and my hope would be they'll say, is this the way we should function as a government and in this federal system that we have? So that's what I hope will come of this. I have no subpoena power. I have no power in terms of altering anything in the course of litigation or in congressional activities or the IG's office. But I hope they'll look at this and say it's pretty fair and balanced how I approached it, and I came out with a responsible conclusion.
I have a quick follow-up. Did EPA give you, I know they didn't make anyone available because of the ongoing litigation, but did they give you any information or say, hey, these are things that you need to consider from our...
No. We did contact, and again, it's in the report, we did contact at least three former EPA officials. That would be Governor Whitman, Governor Leavitt, and Bob...
Perseus,
the acting administrator. And I had conversations with them and basically just asked about the process while they were in office. Did they see this as an unusual, would they have viewed this as an unusual exercise of power? And I think the conclusion from them was they're not familiar with all the facts, but that would be highly unusual in terms of extraordinary to use a preemptive. But beyond that, that's just their opinion, and they said essentially they didn't follow the facts of the case and weren't in a position to give me any judgment on it. So I took it for its value. I just wanted to validate this is really highly unusual. And was it warranted? Because you look back and at this, you say EPA could, once a permit is filed, you go through the whole process. NEPA then has to be complied with. All of the groups in Alaska, everywhere, has an opportunity to then openly share information, and you have a defined project that is defined in what they hope to, the area they hope to mine, and what the consequences would be, what mitigation techniques, what the economic benefit would be, et cetera. All that would be involved in a NEPA. And at any point, once the application and the permit's filed, EPA could come in and say, we've looked at the information and we've come to the conclusion we simply can't permit it, and veto it at that point. And so I failed to understand why they didn't follow that process, and by cutting out and reducing the role of Alaska and defining a limited mine, there was no real justification for how, and I shouldn't say justification, there's no real way of assessing how they came up with a proposed 0.25 million ton mine would be acceptable. Billion ton mine would be acceptable. And what that, how they drew that line, and did they take into account there would be other ancillary things that take place, power lines, ports, et cetera. So it was, again, hypotheticals and using this on a preemptive basis when I thought was unnecessary and unfair.
Let me go through on the phone. Rachel, do you have any questions?
Sure. Yeah, thanks so much for holding the call. I think, you know, I was interested in what you were discussing regarding the use of the Clean Water Act and 404C as a watershed planning tool, and I was hoping that you could expand on what you mean by that, whether that's them determining land use and what is acceptable and what isn't, or if you had another meeting.
No, it came up during the discussions. It's in, I'll pull out the specific page. It's on 103 in the appendix, and can serve as a model of proactive watershed planning for sustainability, similar to alternative futures watershed planning being used in Region 10. And the question is EPA in the watershed planning business? You're now talking about land management, which normally falls to the states. It's just a question here in terms of whether EPA sees this as an opportunity to use this for watershed planning in the future. And is this something that Congress feels it has been delegated to the EPA to undertake? I don't have an answer to that. I think Congress is going to want to look at it and say, you know, either we support that or we don't support it. But I think the thing is, in the Clean Water Act, the regulations in 404C were put in by regulation without any comment from anyone. So it kind of slipped into the law by regulation, but I don't think anyone has focused on it to date because the process has worked to date. Namely, if you follow the traditional process of the NEPA process, everybody gets to have their say, the scientists get to have their say, and the those in the mining business have their say, and the states do. So the real issue is, what is the role of the federal government going to be going forward, and is this a model they intend to use for future states and mining? So I don't have an answer to that question.
And Rachel, just to give you the context of what Secretary Cohen was quoting from, which is, as he noted in page 103 of the appendix, is an EPA document from September 2010. It's entitled A Discussion Matrix for a Headquarters Briefing at EPA, and it discusses as a what it calls one of the pros and cons of proceeding with 404C before the permit application, that such a decision or use of 404C could serve as a model of proactive watershed planning. So this is something that comes from the EPA's own documents.
And just a quick follow-up. I mean, as a former senator, you know, if you were in the Senate right now, what type of questions would you be asking on that front, or where would you look to find the answers and interpret those clauses?
Well, what I would look to, I would be on a committee, and I would have subpoena power, And I would have, obviously, a good working relationship with EPA, which I've always had over the years. And I would ask them to come forward and testify and say, what exactly did you mean by this? And is this what you foresee in terms of the role of EPA in watershed planning in the future? And then just have them on the record, and then other members of Congress say, hey, wait a minute, is that what we intended? And if it is, then fine. But I doubt whether anybody has given this kind of focused attention on the issue, because it's never had to come up before. And that's why I say the normal process has worked quite well. They've used 404C 13 times with success, because they allowed the permit to be filed. They allowed the Army Corps of Engineers to do the work that they're really capable and competent to do, and then allows everybody to have full participation. Here, it was cut short. And to base a decision on hypotheticals, again, that's not something I think that members of Congress are going to want to look at and say, that's not really what the role of EPA should be doing. So EPA has a – look, I think the EPA has an critically important role, and I don't want to diminish that in any way. And I've been a big supporter of EPA and continue to be. I just want to make sure that when there are rules established and the rules are complied with in a fair way, and here I don't think they were applied in a fair fashion. That's all I'm saying. And again, my word may carry no weight with members of Congress. I doubt it will carry any weight with EPA. But at least by helping to focus the issues and say, here are all of the facts that I've assembled with the great assistance of Charlie and DLA, I hope it's helpful to you. I hope it's helpful to the IG. I hope it's helpful to members of Congress and even the courts. They can look at it and say, as independent an analysis as can be made has been made, and people will make their own judgments in terms of whether they think it's fair.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Erica, do you have any questions?
Yeah, sure, thanks. So I'd like to go back to
Rachel 11.
You said that they were not allowed
now
to
exiting.
File
permit. I'm sorry.
We lost it. Can you repeat that?
Yeah,
can you start over, Erica? Sorry.
So you said earlier that Temple Mine is not allowed to file a permit. And I wonder what your thoughts are. This doesn't really answer the question of why EPA cut them short, but, you know, there was talk for years and years of Temple Mine to file a permit, any month now, any day now. And, you know, there was an impression for some time that the mine was choosing to wait it out. They were choosing to wait after the 2012 election to hope to get a friendlier agency towards their business. Do you think that wait, the long period of time that it took before they never filed the permit application, do you think that had anything to do with the agency's behavior?
Well, you know, good question. You know, very good question. It's interesting because I can't judge whether or not what the mindset is of the Pebble folks as whether when they want to file it. But it was interesting in terms of the agency, EPA, saying that there was documentation. I can have Charlie Scheer bring it out for you. There's information in which the EPA indicated that they wanted to file this Bristol Bay Water assessment after the 2012 elections. I'm sorry, 2010 elections. And that was something they were ready to file it, but the document indicates they should wait until after the elections. Again, why did they feel that were they planning on having a different change in party alliance or whatever? I don't know. Then there is the document which indicates, let's get this water assessment finished before the Pebbles can file their application. So you have EPA saying, let's finish the Bristol Bay Water watershed assessment before they get a chance to file. So I don't know how much gaming is going on in this, but it's not up to EPA or anyone else, including the federal government or me, to say when you should file it. a person who has an opportunity to exercise his that company decides when it's in their interest to file it. They may never file it. But the point is, nothing can be done there until there is an application that is filed and all the permits applications have been gone through. Not a shovel of dirt can be turned. So the question becomes, who is trying to game it? I don't know. But I think that's worth looking at in terms of why were they so concerned initially in 2010 that we have to wait to file a document until after the election. And then when they had the Bristol Bay Water Shed assessment saying we've got to get this completed before Pebble can file their application. So these are issues that need to be explored, and I don't have access to the mindset, and that's one of the issues. That's one of the reasons why I didn't want to really try and prejudge. EPA may have very high motivations on all of this. They may have been calculating all along that they were just waiting for the right time. If you go back to the documents, you'll find that Phil North indicated that 404C was ripe to be used, and that was as early as 2005, so that's 10 years ago. And if you look at the communications in between, you'll find that that's something that they have planned on for a long time. If you look at the budget application, for example, for 2011, to add, I think it was $287,000, so they were requesting for additional funds before they had completed the Bristol Bay Water Shed assessment, they were already applying for funds for 404C. So, were they making a decision? Had they made a decision before they had completed their own assessment, which was lacking in the sense that it didn't contain any mitigation? It didn't have a specified design for the mine, and it didn't have any mitigation techniques that could be used, and they didn't have a cost-benefit analysis. So were they already pre-committed to the 404C? I mean, there's enough information there for other people to explore to say that's something really worth looking at. And I, being, sitting back and looking at, I don't want to prejudge it. As I said, there was some information. The documentation has been recently produced. It's quite benign. It's been missing for over a year or longer. It finally got produced, and it's quite benign. And that may be true of all the documents that have been lost. They're still trying to recover information from Phil North's computer that crashed. Now, maybe they'll be able to recover it, maybe they won't. But again, there's information there that needs to be explored, and the best thing to do, really, is to have a congressional hearing and explore these issues. People on the record, under oath, producing documents that are in their files and saying, here's why we did what we did and why we decided that we could not afford to allow Pebble to file a permit request application.
And Erica, to give you the two reference points to the statements to which Secretary Cohen was alluding, on page 44 of his report, there's an email from an individual with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who'd spoken with Mr. North, who indicated that EPA had decided to proceed with 404C, but would likely do so after the November election. And that's a September 2010 email. And then on page 51, there's an email from Mr. North, who Secretary Cohen has spoken about, talking about the need to complete the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment before PLP, the Pebble Partnership, submits their applications. So those gives you the reference points for those two statements.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Alex, do you have questions?
Yeah, I'm here. I was wondering if you think Congress needs to revisit the Clean Water Act and make it clear that they don't think EPA should be able to preemptively and maybe retroactively veto these water permits?
Well, Congress may look at this and come to a different conclusion, saying we think they do have this power, and should. I don't know if they will, but they need to have exercise oversight. Again, they haven't had to in the past in terms of the process as it's been established has worked very well. And so when they used 404C, and the 13 times they did, there was very little controversy because they went through the NEPA process. And if you go back and look at the Natural Resources Defense Council, they have said that the NEPA process is democratic at its core. It gives everybody an opportunity to have a full explanation and participation in the process. So it can't be, you can't have it both ways and say that, gee, this is democratic to the core, but then use a process which is not as democratic as the other. So I think Congress will want to look at it, and members will say, and there'll be vigorous debate on it, as to whether or not they think this power should be granted or should be exercised in these kinds of circumstances where a permit hasn't been filed. And that's why I pointed to the fact that it's never been used before except in that one case in Florida. And only there was it used because they had two adjoining parcels that had already been, applications for a permit had been filed, and they made a judgment after the filing process through the NEPA process to veto it. So again, that's, and they looked at the adjoining parcel, the third parcel, and they said, no need. We already have all the information we need, and it's been fully explored. And so we can exercise that veto there without a permit having been filed. But that's pretty extraordinary. And so I think Congress will want to look at this and say, what's the role of the EPA and versus the states? And because, you know, states do have rights, but they're subordinate when it comes to the power is with the federal government. But even the federal government has to exercise that power with, you know, reason, responsibility, openness, candor, provide its full an array of witnesses and documentation for its actions. And that's the only point I would make. I'm a big fan of EPA, and I've enjoyed the support of environmentalists over the years. And I come from the state of Maine, vacation land, so I know something about the environment. And all I want to do is say, let's act fairly under the circumstances. And they may come to an entirely different conclusion. And they may decide to say that we think it was inappropriate for this exercise, or they may confirm it. I don't know at this point, but it's not for me to say. All right, Charlie, did they know, have they met you on the phone?
Yes, it's Charlie Sheeler. I've been piping up from time to time. All right. Dave, any questions from you?
Sure. Good morning, Secretary. One question here. Maybe a two-part. You know, this is obviously a very contentious issue for folks here in Bristol Bay, many of whom are decidedly against the mine and supportive of the EPA's actions so far. I may be wrong, but I bet I'm going to get a bunch of press releases here very shortly deriding this as a bought and paid for report that Pebble got. So I'd ask you, Mr. Secretary, one, would you disclose what Pebble paid? But two, how would you respond if that attack is offered here this morning, which I'd bet it will be?
Yeah, the policy of my firm is we don't discuss clients' billings. It's standard commercial practice for me. I don't charge any more, any less for any client. But that's something that we keep within our firm in terms of our compensation. I can say this. That under no circumstances were any part of the fee charge contingent upon an outcome. I said, you'll get the report, whether you like what I say or not, and no part of the fee is contingent upon that. But let me get back to the second aspect of what you've asked. I value my reputation above all else. I went to law school many years ago, and I've always been mindful of the fact that the one thing you must never do is compromise your integrity. When I was a young congressman during the impeachment proceeding, my first term, you know, the Republican Party was my biggest financial supporter. And yet I felt compelled to point out that I thought the president had committed impeachable offenses. The party's still my principal supporter during the Iran-Contra affair. And I served on the Intelligence Committee at that time, but I also served on the Iran-Contra Committee and worked very hard to make sure I had all the facts. And what I found, I thought was pretty threatening to our democratic system in terms of having, you know, an off-the-shelf, self-sustaining covert capability. and didn't hesitate to write and support the opinion, and in fact joined with Senator Mitchell. He and I wrote a book together. He was a colleague of mine from Maine, a Democratic leader. He and I wrote a book together called Men of Zeal, in which we both joined in citing where government had acted excessively and inappropriately and violated the law. So I've tried to establish a career of one of fairness and independence, and I believe the fact that I was selected by President Clinton to serve in his administration, first time in the history an elected official from a different party was put in a position like Secretary of Defense, I think my reputation for independence and fairness was partly responsible for that, maybe in a good part responsible for that. So I don't take these issues casually. This is not something that I would treat with, I'll just give it a once through and say, here's my judgment. I know what the stakes are involved here, and I know how important it is to the state of Alaska, and I know how important it is to the tribes and to the fishing industry and the sport fishing industry and the source of income to those who depend upon it. My only point was that in exercising authority by the federal government, it needs to be done in a way that is fair. And there was a fair way to have reached a conclusion. It might very well have reached the same conclusion if they had filed a permit designating a specific mine that could then be examined by the Corps and all the parties involved with all of the science involved, and then come to a conclusion that we're going to veto it. But at least it would have been a fair process, a fairer process. And so my only effort here, again, not to make judgments about motivations or illegality or inappropriateness, but saying under these circumstances, given the magnitude of the issues involved, given the fact you had the largest sockeye salmon industry and capability in the world, and given the fact you're going to have one of the biggest copper mines in the world if it ever went forward, these are big issues. And when you're dealing with big issues, deal with it in a way that's the most open so that everybody has a chance to have their say on the record and put it to an examination, a critical examination, and say, okay, under the circumstances, we decide this can't go forward, et cetera. So, they can question my independence, but I can tell you I've spent more time going through these records than I have practically on any other case that my firm deals with. And we deal with issues all over the world. In China, India, the Middle East, I can tell you that I have devoted more time to this than almost any other case I've worked on.
Dave, we would just add one request to anyone who claims this is bought and paid for or biased, and that is simply read the report and then judge for yourself. I think the report speaks for itself in terms of how it goes about chronicling what has happened here and then the conclusion Secretary Cohen reaches.
Thank you both for that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you all for your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks much.
Take care.